This is an ABC podcast.
It's a rarity for a new business to open up in a country town these days.
As a child growing up and going to school, every shop in town had somebody in it, but not now, not now. The town has gone back a lot.
But the town of Nil is one town bucking that trend. We're going to head there. And the self-called surf witches taking on the blokey culture of surfing.
There's lots of kind of men out in the lineup and they're all kind of very serious and they don't want to talk to you and they're all kind of dropping on your waves. Well, not all of them, but there are some. It's just hard to know how to handle that kind of attitude.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide. But first to South Australia, where November temperature records have been broken in more than a dozen spots. It hit 46 degrees on the Nullarbor and Narracourt was as high as 40 degrees. The hot, windy conditions are making it very difficult for firefighters to battle the 45 fires currently burning across the state. Reporter Helen Frost gave us a quick update of the situation a short time ago.
So far, we've had 45 fires burning across the state today, from the Fluorio to the Barossa to the state's mid-north. The one that is most concerning firefighters at the moment is at Yorktown. That's on the lower York Peninsula. And towns including Wattle Point are at threat there. So that is an emergency level. And people are being told to stay where they are. They can't leave. That's too late. We saw four schools enact their bushfire plan in those areas and students were kept inside. They've now been allowed to leave because it is a lower risk in the area. So at the moment, SA Power Networks is saying that if conditions get worse, that's why they will keep the power off. So that could be up until 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. So about 14,000 residents could be without power all night. So firefighters are saying don't be complacent overnight. The fire threat is not gone. Do not go outside and do not do any activities that might spark a bushfire because they are on watch and bracing for the worst conditions coming into this evening.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. Research has found women wearing hijabs are the most common targets of Islamophobic incidents in Australia. Alma Mohammed belongs to the only Muslim family in the small Queensland town of Gordonville. This is her experience.
I was driving on the highway and the person was doing pistol shape with their hands and yelling stuff to us, swerving his car at me. My daughter was in the car. She was crying. I went straight to the Edmonton police station. Unfortunately, that police station, which is for a large area, was unmanned at the time. So I was pressing the button. Doors were shut. He had actually followed me around past the police station, but then continued to drive off.
That's fourth-generation sugarcane farmer Alma Mohammed, who lives in Gordonville outside of Cairns in far north Queensland. They're the only Muslim family in the small town and her family has been in Australia for more than 100 years, but that does not protect her from racist slurs telling her to go back to where she came from. She's not alone. A major study from the Charles Sturt University has found women wearing head coverings are the most common targets of Islamophobic incidents in Australia. The report analysed hundreds of allegations of Islamophobia and in only 10 cases was it reported that someone stopped to help the victim. Alyssa Parker is part of the Islamic Women's Association of Australia and she joins me now from a studio in Toowoomba where she lives. Alyssa, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
Thank you for having me.
Now tell me, does Alma Mohammed's experiences ring true to your own?
Yes, it does, unfortunately.
Do you want to tell me a little of those experiences?
Well, so I've had a very similar experience where I'll tell you two different experiences. One where I was simply parked at a set of lights with the children in the car, and it was very similar to Alma's, where a gentleman motioned towards my vehicle with his hand in the shape of a pistol and proceeded to make that gesture as if he was shooting at our car. The second instance, which was the most concerning, which I had my youngest child with me, who was five at the time, this happened a few months. It happened on five separate occasions where a young adolescent boy would walk behind us down the street as we'd carry our shopping home, and he would proceed to yell out Allah Akbar. My young child was, she has a pre-existing condition of anxiety, and it was quite confronting for us to have that happen on not one but several occasions. The same in our story is we went to the local law enforcement and addressed to them what was happening and was told, well, there's not really much we can do about it.
How do your children cope with that happening in their lives? Like, how do you think it affects them?
They don't cope well, no. This year has been particularly hard for us in our small town, they have a strong front, but no, it's not good.
Why do you say it's been hard for you this year in particular?
This year with the Christchurch massacre, I believe the Islamophobia has definitely become more public on social media and in everyday life, which, yeah, it's a very challenging thing to deal with on a daily basis.
What age are your children, Alyssa?
They are now 12 and 7.
So your 12-year-old, how do you think it's affecting them? As they're a bit older and they're starting to understand how they fit into the world.
It's not affecting her well. We engage in long chats, and we have engaged in counsellors as well. We are now moving to a different school outside of our local town, and this is one of the reasons, because I just don't want my children to be in that toxic environment where they feel they shouldn't have to justify their mother's existence, basically. That's the only way I can describe it. And that's unfortunately what's put on them at such a young age, basically because I choose to wear a hijab. Yeah.
So you find they're being targeted because of you wearing the hijab? That's particularly why you stand out, so therefore kids are picking on them.
That is correct. They've had their friends come to school and make comments which typically children wouldn't have any knowledge about, and so those comments come home, and then I have to go into protection mode as a mother and talk them through it as best I can. So,
has the school helped at all in terms of educating children about the Islamic religion?
Well, this is what we're working on, hopefully in 2020. To this date, no. We do have events such as Harmony Day, and as they go to a Catholic school, we teach them about inclusion and things like that. But specifically on Islam, no, that has yet to reach our town.
So how is it for you then, Alyssa, as a Muslim woman and your daughter entering into that next phase of life, teaching her about her religion and saying, look, this is what's important to us, and this we want this to be part of your life, if she's having this very negative experience at such a tender age?
That's a great question. How do you support that? I just have to be the best example I can be to my daughter. And as she is growing up and getting older, I'm telling her about, you know, our government and our law enforcement services that are being so proactive in social inclusion and social cohesion, so that she is able to meet the negative narrative with confidence. That's really all I can do.
Do you think it's harder for you because you do live in a town in regional Queensland?
Absolutely. That's a definitive answer. If I was to live within Toowoomba, the issues I have on a daily basis would not exist, or would rarely exist.
So you think from living, because you live on the outskirts of Toowoomba, it's even worse?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why do you choose to live there?
Well, it's where my children's father's family is. So we're keeping them in that area. It is, and it has the potential to be a lovely country town. We're not too far from the city, and it's the lifestyle. It's the country lifestyle that I wanted my children to experience growing up.
You've spoken about the effect on your children. Well, what about for you? Has it been isolating as an Islamic woman living outside of a major regional town in Queensland?
Yes. It's very isolating. There really is not many people I can confide in or gain support with within that particular community. There have been many times where I have called my connections with the Federal Police and the Muslim Advocacy Network, where I've called them in tears, just saying, I just need to get through this comment or this behaviour. And that's very challenging.
Alyssa Parker, thanks very much for coming in and talking to Australia Wide.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I didn't know Melbourne much. I knew where the racecourses were.
I'm making signs for the sleepy lizards.
Basically less eggs this year than what we would have expected.
The houses that are near the edge of the bush, they might encounter a snake up to 4 times a year, a death adder.
See how it goes.
On ABC Radio.
Spix and Specs is back for an Oz music special.
We'll have a cast of thousands, including Missy Higgins, Brian Mannix, Thelma Plum, G-Flip, Rove McManus, Nina Ayama, the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra.
How raucous are orchestras?
Are they potentially a raucestra?
Can I answer this question?
Yes.
The orchestra left Beethoven's second movement in the shallow end.
Spix and Specs Oz Music Special, Sunday 7:40 on ABC TV and iView.
And right now you're listening to Australia Wide and you're with me, Sinead Mangan. The idea of a tree change doesn't really translate to small business owners. With declining populations and lines of empty shop windows, few rural towns attract people wanting to start a new venture. But where a series of doors had long been closed, one family decided to open up in the Wimmera town of Nil. A Melbourne baker gambled everything to open a cafe in the small town to the bemusement of locals. Danny Greenley has the story.
The town of Nil is almost exactly halfway between Melbourne and Adelaide, a 4-hour drive from either major city. Like most rural towns, locals have seen the decline of small business.
I've lived here all my life. My name's Beryl. As a child growing up and going to school, every shop in town had somebody in it. But not now. Not now. The town has gone back a lot.
Which is why Beryl was shocked to see the opposite. 2 months ago, out-of-towners opened Mr. Lee's Cafe Bakery.
I just felt, are you making a big mistake to come up here to see opening a business, to see how it's going to go? Yeah.
As you can hear, Mr. Lee's at Nil sits on a major highway. Its owner is Tung Lee.
Apparently the previous owner didn't go successful, so she offered us the building.
An empty shop where another hospitality business had just failed. Locals weren't the only sceptics. Mr. Lee was unable to loan any money for renovations.
We asked every bank, they say it's too far and the town's too small.
It meant having to sell both Melbourne and Ballarat operations. But business wasn't Mr. Lee's first priority.
I have 3 children. They all sick, so it's better get more fresh air for them.
Mr. Lee's 2 younger children have autism.
Like my young boy is way overactive, and the girl she don't want to talk to anyone. So it's really tough.
The move to Nil came with its own challenges: finding school aides, a speech pathologist, a psychologist and a nanny to assist with the kids' needs.
It's only a matter we have to travel. Sometimes we have to travel to Melbourne. You win one thing, you lost another.
Mr. Lee said the Nil community had embraced his family.
They always open wide for you.
And his business.
I start with 7 staff. The first week is we can't handle. Some customers waiting a couple of hours for the food.
It was absolutely packed, throngs of people.
Joan was there on opening day.
You know, the queue was hanging out the door, so we thought we'd come back the next day.
So you came, but you left with no food?
Yeah, we left with no food.
Mr. Lee's is a difficult place to put in a box. It's a bakery with all the bread and pies and pastries cooked on site, and a cafe with the coffee machine and slices and newspapers on the tables. And then there's the full Vietnamese menu. You might assume, like I did, that Mr. Lee added the bakery side of things to his Vietnamese business to keep locals happy. In fact, it was the other way around. His family has been baking since they arrived in Australia in 1980. Mr. Lee was a young boy.
Back then, it's really a tough life in Vietnam, so we all go as a boat to Indonesia as a refugee, and then we arrived in Australia. I really remember in the boat for 7 days, and then we got to Indonesia for 6 months, so it was really tough.
Nearly 40 years on, Mr. Lee sees himself as Aussie and a baker. But on a visit to Nil, locals said they would love to try some Vietnamese cuisine.
The Vietnamese traditional food is so popular, so we stick what we do at the moment.
The popularity meant Mr. Lee had to find another 11 staff members, a huge challenge in a small rural town. But Nil isn't any ordinary town. And the solution to Mr. Lee's issue came from a man who found himself in this same position a decade ago. Famously, John Millington, the managing director of Nil-based company Love a Duck, actively recruited Karen refugees. Nil's Karen population built to more than 200. Mr. Lee's business offers the next chapter in the migrant story.
My name is Sher. I lived in Nil for about 9 years.
Sher's dad was among the first Karen people to take up Love a Duck's job offers. On completing her year 12, she was on the verge of leaving to work and study in Melbourne when Mr. Lee showed up. A full-time job here means she can stay and study online.
My mum does want me to go far too, so I have to stay with her.
She's studying community development with plans to give back. In small rural towns like Nil, 17 jobs, 17 people like Sher with goals and plans can have a huge impact. Lifelong locals like Heather McCartney notice.
Yeah, I do. I do notice more people come. Like, oh, I laugh, I say, oh, I don't know a lot of people that live here now, but I'm sure they're all nice people. We're lucky, really.
Opening day was a couple of months ago now, and Mr. Lee's is still buzzing.
We come here for coffee every day, don't we?
You get in, yeah.
Mr. Lee is reluctant to declare his business a success yet. But while rural towns do bring challenges, he sees huge potential for other small business tree change dreamers.
If you have something there for the visitor coming, they always stop.
In particular, he sees a bright future for his new hometown of Nil.
One by one, some other small business as well start build up in the area, so we hope the town is boom up.
Tung Lee, he's the owner of Mr. Lee's Cafe / Bakery / Vietnamese Restaurant in Nil in Western Victoria. And that story from Danny Greenlee. Learning to surf can be very challenging, but when you also add busy beaches and a male-dominated competitive environment, it can put new surfers off, particularly women. This is where Gold Coast Group, the Surf Witches, come in. Surf Witches are an all-female surfing group that aims to create a friendly, supportive network for female amateur surfers. Co-founder Hannah Jessup spoke with Dominic Cansdale about the group and how it's taking on blokey surf culture.
So the Surf Witches is a community of female surfers on the Gold Coast. So we're all ages, all levels, different nationalities, just all brought together by our love of surfing. None of us are like pros or anything. We're just still out to give it a go and encourage and cheer each other on.
How did it begin?
So it began when I started surfing with one of my friends, which was literally only in January this year. So I'm no surfing expert or anything.
So you've only been surfing since the start of the year?
Yeah, only since January.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So my friend and I were out there and we were kind of giving it a go and out almost every day just trying to get better. And we just noticed that together we were kind of better. Like if we went out by ourselves, it was just not as motivating, not as fun. And then we just started meeting other women in the surf and started connecting with them, and they're in the same situation. And we just all had a better time together. We felt safer, more encouraged, more supported.
What do you mean by safer?
Just surfing by yourself, it's very intimidating. So especially as a beginner, just there's lots of kind of men out in the lineup and they're all kind of very serious and they don't want to talk to you and they're all kind of dropping on your waves. Well, not all of them, but there are some.
Yeah.
And just as a beginner especially, it's just hard to know how to handle that kind of attitude. And also the kind of the safety thing is a big thing too, because being out in the ocean by yourself is obviously not a great idea when you don't know what you're doing.
And you've called yourself Surf Witches.
Surf Witches.
Why is that?
Yes. Oh, I think it started with a joke. Someone had a witch's hat on their head, but we ran with it because the whole kind of sisterhood coven thing just kind of worked.
And how big is your group now?
At the moment, our Facebook group is 340 members. So we get about 5 or 10 new requests a day.
Nice.
Which is pretty awesome.
And so do you do regular surf meetups?
We're trying to be more organised. Yeah. So we want to do kind of 1 or 2 scheduled meetups every week. So where we post, you know, we'll be at this beach at this time, whoever wants to come down. Yeah, and then do kind of 1 official fun day every month.
What do you mean by a fun day?
Pick a different break to go down to. So maybe like down south to Cabarita or Byron or something.
Mm.
And make kind of a big day of it where we go out to brekkie or coffees or kind of afternoon session somewhere.
It's like a little club.
Surf. It is, yeah.
And all clubs need a mascot or some sort of uniform. I've noticed you've got a little blue wristband on.
We have little blue wristbands that have surf witches on them. So we wear them in the water so we can kind of, if we haven't met other surf witches, we can identify them, because there's obviously lots of people out in the surf and it's kind of a bit awkward to go up to someone and say, are you a witch? We got some funny looks.
What's the benefit of it all up?
So I just think it's a sense of community. Kind of not easy to kind of meet people on the Gold Coast, I found. So I think I've met more people in the last year than I have in the last 10 years, just through this group.
Mm.
So just making those connections with other women has been amazing.
So when you guys are out there, what are you actually doing on the waves?
Lots of laughing. it depends kind of who's with you. So we have lots of beginners and it's just kind of doing our best to try and stand up on the board, kind of throw out tips if we can, lots of cheering for like the smallest little victory. It's like standing up on like a 1 foot whitewash wave, you all get a cheer and lots of encouragement.
What sort of like demographics are you attracting so far?
Massive. So we've got like 17-year-olds and I think our oldest member's 65. So
what do you make of that? That's a very broad
appeal. I thought
that
was kind of special. Yeah, because we do have that diversity in our group. And I've met people that I never would have run into otherwise, which has been awesome.
Hannah Jessup from the Gold Coast Surf Group, the Surf Witches, speaking there to Dominic Kensdale, rather. Australia-wide's producer, Alex Hyman, has joined me in the studio now. Alex, there's some news from the Hazelwood Power Station.
That's right, Sinead. The Hazelwood Power Corporation has been found guilty of exposing its workers and the local community to risk during the 2014 mine fire in the Latrobe Valley. The operator of the Hazelwood Power Station and mine was today convicted on 10 of 12 charges for endangering its workers and the community 5 years ago. A Supreme Court jury has found the company did not adequately assess the risk of fire, did not have an adequate reticulated water system, and failed to slash vegetation around the mine. Now, you may remember the fire burnt for 45 days, covering the town of Morwell in thick smoke and coal dust. The jury verdict followed a trial which lasted almost 8 weeks, and the penalties on this will be determined at a later date, but that news through this afternoon.
And there'll be more on that on ABC Online. And that's it from the Australia-wide team for today. I hope you have a lovely evening. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.